Looking for a graduation gift to inform, inspire, and encourage? When you give a subscription to Christianity Today, you're giving redemptive, relevant news and thoughtful, balanced dialogue about the church, current issues, and public theology. Visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to get a discounted student subscription for the graduates in your life. Starting at only $2 per month, this gift will engage and grow their faith throughout the year. Click the link in the show notes or visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to order now.
This episode is brought to you by Our Daily Bread Ministries, a global media organization that makes the life-changing wisdom of the Bible understandable and accessible to all. Visit whereyourfrom.org for more information. That's whereyafrom.org.
This is CT Media.
Welcome to Being Human with Steve Cuss. Just a pleasure to be with you. This is one of those episodes that's kind of a lifetime experience for me, because today I'm bringing on the show the chaplain from 1996, the chaplain I worked with at UT Hospital that first introduced me to systems theory. And he himself was trained and studied under the founder of systems theory. For those who have been with me on this journey for several years, you know all about this. But if you are newer to me or my work, I use this phrase systems theory. Essentially, it is the ability and the skill and the art of learning to notice anxiety and reactivity rather than catching it and spreading it. That's how I would describe it in a nutshell. Systems theory is simply a science or a way of walking into any environment and paying attention to what's going on in you and how you are infecting a space and how you are infected by what's going on, because it helps you notice reactivity. I've talked about this a lot in previous episodes, so I won't go into it much. But reactivity is contagious. It kicks us into false reality. So really, as a pastor, I've given a lot of my life, not just to studying theology, but also systems theory. And the first guy to introduce me to it was George Dobler, my guest today. I'll talk a little bit about George, but I'm actually going to pause and light the candle. Now, we light the candle to remember the Lord, to relax into God's presence. This is our Capable Life 3-wick candle. And so when I'm lighting 3 wicks, of course, it's helping me remember that God is Father, into whose presence I can relax. God is Son, who came and lived a human life and did for me what I can't do for myself when he died for my sins. And God is Spirit, that intangible but ever-present help in time of trouble. So we light the candle to relax into God's presence, to pay attention to what's going on right now and give that to God and exchange it for the peace and the freedom that Christ promises. What I love about the Christian gospel is we are guaranteed peace and freedom in spite of circumstances. It's not like we have to have everything lined up. That's what anxiety tells us. But the gospel of Jesus says things can be really rough. That's why I love that the New Testament was written in such a violent context. I mean, these are people that lived in the Roman Empire and yet could access the peace of Christ. As we light the candle, I'm going to invite you to think about the handful of people that have significantly shaped your life, that God has put in your life. I have a number of people who, just by rubbing shoulders with them or things they've said to me or the way they've mentored me, I have a number of people that have changed my life. And I light the candle giving thanks to God for these people. It's just another way I worship God. God is so good that God has given me these people. And one of them is George Dobler. 1996, I was 24. Many of you know my story. I'd been married for 1 week when I walked through the doors of the University of Tennessee Hospital, having no idea what it would mean to be a chaplain. And as I've shared elsewhere, they don't really tell you how to be a chaplain. What they do is they come alongside you and they help you debrief. And it was through that process that George introduced me and all the students to systems theory, this way of managing yourself, this way of noticing dynamics in others. And so this began for me, obviously, a lifelong journey that has shaped my life. So what a treat for me to introduce you to this guy that's had such a profound impact on my life, George Dobler. George just retired from UT Hospital last week at 85. What's your excuse? 85. He stepped down from being the director 17 years ago, but just last week, he finally packed up the office. George is one of those people, as you'll discover in this interview, is a force of nature. He has so much energy, so much curiosity. The George I caught up with, who's 85, has the same energy as the George that I worked for in 1996. I began this interview by asking him how he met Murray Bowen, the founder of systems theory. Let's take a listen.
It was by accident, actually. I was in training at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., and the training program there was not only for chaplains. We would meet together with psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, all in training, and we were in groups. And Murray would come over and speak as part of one of the classes. And my initial contact with him, it was not a great speaker. And so I really didn't listen well to him. It took at least 3 years before I began to realize he's saying something that I need to hear that will help me dealing, especially in the community and with deeply troubled people, because we were working with very, very sick people there at St. Elizabeth's.
And then if you had to explain systems theory to someone that doesn't know what it is, how would you define it briefly for someone?
What Murray did, his whole notion, he emerged from pretty much a psychoanalytic background into realizing there's something biological going on in all of us, that there's something that we've learned at birth and even in utero. And so that he began to realize who we are emotionally is coming out of a system that is simply not what you're learning as you grow up. So he began to look at the parents and then the grandparents and great-grandparents, and he came to the conclusion that schizophrenia was at least a three-generation process. And I said, what? This made no sense to the kind of training I had had, which was pretty individually based. So Murray was looking at understanding ourselves in light of generations of our history. And the more cut off you are from your history, the more anxious you're going to be.
Okay. George, let me take you back to 1996. I'm going to share my point of view of 1996, and then I'd love to hear your side of this.
Good, good.
I graduate from a wonderful and theologically conservative Bible college. I then need a job for a year, and I sort of accidentally stumble into clinical pastoral education chaplaincy, and I show up, and there's you, there's Peter Keyes at the time, our supervisor, and you guys are blowing my world apart by teaching me to notice anxiety, how it impacts me, and most of all, how I am infecting a room when I walk into it. Like before you guys came along and ruined my life, I just thought, oh, I'll walk in and quote Jesus and pray and everything's great. And you guys taught this whole way of you can pay attention to yourself, you can notice how you're infecting spaces, and by noticing that, you can be a more powerful pastoral presence. Now, when I share my side, I'm not asking you to remember me showing up, but you have worked with so many people like me, these young, idealistic, naive pastoral students, and you plunge us into emergency room and ICU. What are you seeing when we're first showing up?
It's interesting how well some people learn and are open to learning in spite of what they're bringing with them. We've had instances where we've had to ask students to look at, you can't learn here. And they'll say, why not? Because they're not willing to be open to learning anything about systems. They're there just to go convert people rather than understanding the process. And so when students come in they do not know what they're going to experience. They think, you know, I'm going to be meet with sick people. I'm going to pray with them and do that. But they really have no idea what the clinical learning process is. But as the time goes on, the group process becomes very important. You're meeting with fellow residents who are going through the same thing, and you begin to know each other and share each other's feelings and realize there's something else going on that I didn't know.
That's almost how I would also help someone understand systems theory. What you just said, George, is there's something else going on that I didn't know. And I think I would add to that, there's something else going on that I didn't know. And as soon as it was named for me, I suddenly knew it was true. When I learned systems theory, it's almost like it explained my life in a way that I never thought of before, but suddenly understood or suddenly made sense of. When I go around and do workshops, it's usually 8 or 10 minutes in, and people are like, how did you know my life so well? And I'm like, oh, I'm not a magician. I'm not a mentalist. I just, systems gives you a way of noticing things that once you see them, you can't unsee it.
The people that are open to hearing it, it's coming from their birth. What you learned as a small child, how you hear that message, you are open to hear that message because your mom and your dad taught you that. You learned something in that family you came from that made you open to hearing that. And then you've got other gifts that come into that, which are developed in that family. And then, so when you become interested in whatever you do, you're bringing that with you. So when you come to us and you get this other message that's different than the one you heard, you are open to hear it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know in my personal experience, I was resistant to it for, I think, 12 weeks. I think the first 3 months I would go home because I was a newlywed. I don't expect you to remember, but I had been married 1 week longer than I'd been a chaplain.
Which is a trauma all of its own.
So. Yes, yeah. And I'd go home to my wife and be like, these people are crazy. Like, this is crazy. And then something for me flipped in the 12-week mark where I was like, these people are life-giving. So when I did my genogram, that was the first moment in my life where I realized, oh, I'm from a dysfunctional family, because part of our family propaganda is we are smart. Like, we are not dysfunctional. If you could summarize the message, we are not dysfunctional. And we did that very dysfunctionally. And I remember in the genogram process, that was a turning point for me. It was like, oh no, I'm from a dysfunctional family. And then immediately, oh, thank God, I'm from a dysfunctional family. I can relax. I can be a human. I don't have to look smart and be smart. And it was really powerful.
See, the whole notion of dysfunction, it's probably not the word, because we're all coming from something that doesn't work well. All families have messes, and we hide them, but some people hide them better than others. Others are pretty obvious. But you know, when I started doing my family system stuff, neither of my parents, my mom finished high school. My dad never finished high school. The fact is, he got kicked out of high school. And my dad was a beer truck driver the whole time I ever knew. He died when I was 19. So I really never got to know my father. But my father could cuss. And his friend said, you know, your dad is the best cusser. He can cuss for 15 minutes and never repeat himself. So I got kicked out of school twice for cussing, once in elementary school and once in high school. During a baseball game, I slid into base and was called out. And the coach on the other team said I should be kicked out because I had my cleats too high. So the umpire kicks me out. And I walked by the bench and I told that coach what I thought of him. Well, standing behind him was the principal of our high school. And he says, come to my office, can't go to class, and bring your father in because you can't go back to school. I said, you don't want to talk to my father. And he said, I want to talk to your father. I says, you don't want to talk to my father. So my dad had to take off work to come. And as we walked in the door of the principal's office, my dad said, you stay out here. He walked in, and I could hear my dad cussing out the principal. So that's the kind of background I had. So people tell me, you've got terrible language. I says, well, yeah, but that's who I am. And so I have to be careful because that stuff I learned very young. whatever belief system we have is still rooted in, where did my dad get that? And my grandfather owned a slaughterhouse. And my dad grew up in a slaughterhouse, you know, butchering pigs and cattle. And, you know, what do you learn doing that? I mean, it's pretty vicious. So all that background, when you came to our program, you brought that with you. And what you did with it, then that's where you develop. And it doesn't stop once you finish. I think the learning coming out of our program takes place after you leave it.
Yeah, that was true in my case. And you talk about your father's mastery of swear words and colorful language. And, you know, he'd be proud, George. You're a wonderfully salty Lutheran pastor yourself. So this general idea that we are formed by not just our family of origin, but multiple generations of our family kind of passed down. You know, what scripture says, the sins of the father are passed to the third and fourth generation.
Wonderful. Yes.
The other thing that's fascinating to me is not just what is from inside of us, but what's coming at us. And that was the other marked training of chaplaincy, is you plunged us into rooms of death almost every day, like death after death after death. And if it wasn't death, it was cancer diagnoses and burn victims. Like, no one is sitting around a hospital room bored saying, you know what would make this better? Let's bring the chaplain in. He's like, they're always calling when they're desperate. And so then now we have the worst of life coming at us as young students, and that's equally forging. I'd love to get your take on what that is.
Yeah, that when you go into the chaplaincy thing, you don't think about that.
Yeah.
You're not thinking about, I'm going to be dealing with death every day, because we had 3 to 8, in the large medical center, we had 3 to 8 deaths a day, some days more.
Yeah.
But you begin to realize that the person who died isn't the issue. It's the family that's there, and what they're, how they're grieving, and how do you help them at that time grief? Some of them just leave the room, can't deal with it. Others holler and scream, and we don't know them initially. But you spend half hour, 45 minutes with somebody in that situation, you learn them. If you learn to listen, you can learn a great deal. Murray Bowen said, "If there is a funeral in your family, you go." And I said, well, you know, why? He says, you'll learn more standing by a casket with a loved one and listening to people than you'll learn in 10 years of therapy.
One of the things that you specifically taught that I've remembered my whole life, I may have changed the wording of it, George, so I'm going to quote it back to you, but you may not have quite said it this way. But I remember you pulled me aside for emergency room chaplaincy, and you said, the patient comes in on the gurney from the helicopter or the ambulance, but then 1 or 2 minutes later, a very anxious family shows up. And your job as the chaplain is to figure out what was going on in that family 1 minute before their phone rang. The idea that the emergency exposes the dynamic, it doesn't create the dynamic. And as a chaplain, you let the emergency help you discover their existing long-term dynamic. I have used that in pastoring ever since that. Was that remotely accurate to what you actually told us?
Yeah, it is. Because what they're coming in with is, what kind of mourning did they have? You know, especially if someone was killed and they had an argument before he left to go to work, or other things were going on in the family. And that'll come out very quickly in a lot of these families, because all the controls are off in those kind of traumas. I mean, it's amazing. So if we get a chance to work with them and can send them on, if they've got a pastor, we can get a hold of the pastor and say, hey, you've got this. And many pastors were very open to that kind of help.
Yeah.
If they don't have a pastor, a lot of these things don't get resolved. They just don't get resolved.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m. we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on.
Okay.
based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November. It's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
I think for me personally, this is getting off systems a little bit, but maybe it's not. I came into chaplaincy with a certain theology, by which I mean I was certain of it. And there's nothing like death to really test the foundation on which you stand. I guess what I'm saying, George, is I think every pastor, their preaching and their leadership is improved by being plunged into death and trauma and chaplaincy.
That's one of the reasons that clinical pastoral education did develop, because back in the 50s, it became a number of the denominations began to realize that a summer experience in a hospital changed their whole way of learning after. Yeah. So that the Episcopalians, the Lutherans, the Methodists, they began to require that kind of training.
Yeah.
What's curious now is that some of that is dropping off. Some of the denominations are, and I think it has to do with what's going on in our culture. The anxiety is out there so high, they're looking for answers, not questions. And so everybody's wondering, what's the answer? And so going into a hospital and doing that kind of training, you don't come out with a lot of answers.
Yeah, that's right. So George, Murray Bowen's most famous student, I think, is Edwin Friedman. I think people who maybe are not familiar with systems may have read his most famous book, which is Failure of Nerve. I would have to say, I don't believe it's his best book. I think his best book is Friedman's Fables, which I think is his least known book.
Yeah.
But you knew Edwin Friedman. What was he like?
Yeah, we had Friedman here in Knoxville twice, maybe three times. He was an incredible thinker. And when you read his stuff, how can some one person put that kind of information together and do with what he did with it? And to hear him lecture and speak, he did the same thing. He was entrancing. He would make you realize what I knew, I didn't know.
Yeah.
When I thought I knew this, I didn't know it. But as a human being, very affable. It could be funny, but my contacts with him were always in teaching situations. So when he died, I knew that Failure of Nerve, he was writing it. I knew it was at the publisher and it hadn't been printed. And so I called his wife because I'd gotten to know him in Washington because he was at St. Elizabeth's also. We got to talk. And he was in classes with us. He was studying with Bowen. And so he was a student. And so I called his wife and said, you know, is there any way that I can get a hold of that document? She said, you send me some money and this and I'll get it copied and send it to you. So I've got this pre-publication copy that I don't know if I'm supposed to have it or not. But
well, let's see it.
It's here.
Yeah, for our video audience, George has a personalized Kinko's version of Failure of Nerve from Ed Friedman's wife.
Yeah, he died sitting at his desk writing this book, and his wife thought he was at the office. She got a call saying his patients were waiting for him, and he wasn't there. So she looked in the driveway. The car was still there. She went in the office and found him. He had died. In Failure of Nerve, he writes about his heart disease.
Yeah, that's wild. For those unfamiliar with the story, he's being rolled into his heart surgery on the gurney. He's noticing his surgeon's anxiety. He knows that that's going to lessen the chances of a good surgery. So he's helping calm his surgeon on the way to his own open heart surgery. I'm like, who is this guy?
Yes. Yeah. How do you do that? And I think part of the difficulty people have of understanding Friedman and Bowen is that they're thinking beyond us.
Their thinking is too unconstrained. We don't know how to hang our hat on such unconstrained thinking.
And Friedman says in his book, the people who made changes, the most significant changes in the Renaissance, all were people who were thinking outside of the norm. And he talks about the class of 93. And he's talking about 1493. And he lists all the people who were alive in 1493. I couldn't believe it. You look at it and realize all these people who were alive in 1493 in the Renaissance made significant changes in science and art. And then he makes the comment, no new cathedral was begun after 1493. Not, some had been planned and they were, but no new cathedral was designed because the church was so rocked by the fact that there was this other world. And the world ahead was right here. And his whole notion is, how do we realize that there's still stuff that's beyond us? I marvel at these guys that are doing this deep sea diving and finding stuff 2,000 feet underwater. That's right here, let alone what's on the moon or up in space. So I don't know how to think about that. Somebody does.
Yeah.
And Oak Ridge is right across the way here. And so there's some of the most incredible scientific minds in the country are there. I get to preach over there once in a while, and they're in, the scientists are in church. And I'm saying, I'll be doggone. And some of these guys said, I said, why do you have this belief system in your science? Why do you come to church? And they say, because there's something beyond what we're doing.
Yeah.
What do you call it, God or whatever? There is something more to life than any of us understand.
Yeah, something more than can just be proven scientifically. And I do think this is the great gift of system series. If you can get your mind around it, it does help you notice your assumptions, test your assumptions, push through constraints. For Friedman to use system theory to understand exploration in the 15th century, who's doing that? Or the other stream of system theory you and I haven't even gotten to today, maybe in a future episode we can talk about Bateson and the Mental Research Institute guys, but they were chasing emotional change by studying thermonuclear dynamics. Like, they just had such openness to explore. And I think that's how they're helping us in our relationships. And of course, now the challenge is for people like us to take these very conceptual people and give some concrete action to them. I know that's what I'm trying to do. George, you have been at countless bedsides for somebody's last heartbeat. You have sat in Murray Bowen's classes writing down notes directly while yawning. You have rubbed shoulders with Ed Friedman. You've raised $5 million for your hospital to have a chaplaincy program in perpetuity, which is extremely rare. But you have not yet successfully endured the being human gauntlet of anxiety. So without further ado, I propose to you these five questions. The first question: what is a personality trait in another person that is guaranteed to irritate you?
Somebody has all the answers. They'll just piss me off. Especially clergy who come in and if they say, Jesus wanted your baby more than you,
Okay. So when you are in an irritated state, or even perhaps you're fantasizing about violently clotheslining that pastor, what is something that you do for yourself that helps you stay connected to that person and see them as human?
Well, it depends on who they are. It's not going to be the same for everyone, but often I'll say, they just don't know. And then I remember, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do.
Okay.
And they don't. And that calms me down. And I'm not going to be able to change them. You can't do that. You can't change somebody's mind by arguing. So I just let it go.
All right. Question three. In your leadership or your pastoring or your chaplaincy, answer however you like, where do you keep running into yourself? What's a trait you wish you could break?
I didn't play enough. I love boating. I mean, I had go fast boats, jet boat, and I had a fountain offshore racing boat. And I had them, but I didn't use them. I live on the lake. And people say, well, when were you on the water last? And I can't remember. Were you out? No. So I make play, and I firmly believe that playfulness is deeper than seriousness.
Yeah, more playfulness. All right, question 4 of 5. If you treated yourself as well as you treated other people, what's one way of dealing with yourself that would change?
It's a great question. I've never thought about how well would. I'm super aware of the need to change. But my wife will tell you, I slip back into my old stuff. At home, at work, I can pretty well regulate, but at home, I can slip back into my old stuff. I wish I would listen to her better. She does tell me stuff. She had all this experience with all these mentally ill people too. So she would say, why are you worried about that? Or why are you thinking about that? And I said, well, you know, I got to do something about that. She says, yeah, I have to do nothing with that. So there's some things I don't need to be. I don't need to do it. I don't. I got a call yesterday. Somebody said, can you do something about this? And I thought about it and I said, no, I can't do it.
Yeah. Okay. Last question. When in your life lately have you felt most fully and completely loved?
You know, I just retired last week.
At 85?
At 85. I just retired.
What took you so long? Come on.
I stepped down as director 17 years ago. And when I stepped down as director, the CEO said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to keep seeing people. And he says, well, see them here. And I said, I don't want to get in the way of the chaplaincy program. And he says, okay, well, you know, I'll put your position under mine and we'll give you a new title. So they call me a special advisor. That's my title on my door up until last week. And I loved it because nobody wants advice. So I could do whatever I want, come and go when I wanted. But when I left, when I was leaving, people, they kept wanting to do a party. I said, I had a party 17 years ago. A businessman here in town gave a really big going away thing. I said, I had my party 17 years ago. So, but people said, we want to do something. We still want to do something. And I said, well, then we'll figure out later. So the department, I'm sure it's going to do something later. But the fact that, you know, at 85, they're saying, hey, you don't have to go. It's taken me a long time to finally realize I'm getting old.
Well, I can understand, George, you do have so much young energy. My guest has been George Dobler. George is the man that first introduced me to systems theory. He set me on a path that has shaped the way I relate to my wife, my kids, pastoring, theology, my relationship with God. George, what an absolute pleasure for me. Thank you so much for coming on Being Human.
Oh, thank you. Seldom do we hear what our students have done with their lives. Great to be in touch with you again.
Being Human is a production of Christianity Today. It's executive produced by Eric Petrick and Mike Cosper. It's produced and edited by Matt Stevens. The associate producers are Mackenzie Hill and Ray Gilliam, with music by Dan Phelps, mix engineer Kevin Morris, and graphic design by Amy Jones.
Every day, CT testifies to the reality that Jesus is alive, transforming his world and bringing his kingdom to bear. Jesus transforms, CT equips. Make a gift to our nonprofit ministry with a gift of $20 to provide 150 more people with redemptive storytelling, global perspective, and thoughtful podcasts. Give now at morect.com/equip.